further question?
Mr. President, John Connor, the president of the personal plan.
Why, and you are standard, this is your line for.
Good, be happy to.
Thank you.
You have to be right.
Scott, Gene Taylor, of course, from Missouri.
Gene, how are you this year?
Scott, you're in there, from South Dakota, of course.
Yes, sir, how are you?
Real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we had over there on a desk before.
Scott, Bob Daniels, remember? Scott, Ralph Reagan.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
Kenneth. Right.
Scott, Stan Ferris, Charlie Sanders.
Good, good. And the Republican.
Yes, sir.
That's great.
Thank you. Dave Tall, who can ask. Maybe a few minutes later, he gets close.
Oh, sure.
couldn't look.
Years
rather just go away with the pie, which is always the easiest way. And of course, that's a little bit of a self-serving statement, because I remember the first time I was in this office, I believe it or not, by my congressional congressman, I was in this office with a congressman who was out there, Charlie Kirsten from Wisconsin. I don't know why Harry Trump saw us. He wouldn't see me after we had a few arguments later. And I remember he had a little sign on his desk, "Buck stops here." And it's there always on this desk, symbolically. It does stop here. And when you wonder about budgets and the rest, I'm sure you know, it would be much more pleasant for us to see the Congress budget provide everything for everybody. So all we did is increase the budget this year over last year by $18 billion. People wonder, is it enough? And when you look at any specific program, of course it never is. And if you look at the polls around the country, you'll find, and this is not surprising, your own polls will show this, polls are international, will show that do a majority of the people favor more money for education? Yes, 70%. The majority of the people favor spending more money for housing? Yes, perhaps 65%. The majority of the people favor spending more money for the cities, et cetera, in this direction, the rest of the country, all the GMs. And the factor is 65 to 70%. The difficulty is that doesn't ask the right question. And the critical question is, would you be willing to pay more taxes to provide more money for education? You ask that, and it's 72% of the country say no. That's the issue. You say, but this my little bill, for this and that, the other hand, it doesn't require more taxes. It's never that. It's like the mayor of the guy, the breakthrough here or there or the other place. And once it begins to pile up, in the end, they have to face the fact. Either when the budget goes beyond full employment revenues, either you have inflation or you raise taxes. And that's why we had to take this line. And so though it's a tough decision from my standpoint, as much as we would like to do it, we are doing an awful lot, as you know, perhaps more than we should in some areas. But nevertheless, let me say that what you are doing, in effect, those of you who have stood up, as you have so effectively, for spending limitation, those of you who will, I hope, on whenever you possibly can, stand with the president on vetoes. Remember, I'm not vetoing more money for education. I'm not vetoing better health. I'm not vetoing better housing. I'm vetoing a tax increase. That should be the real issue. And if that is clearly understood, if you get that across to your constituents, then I think you'll be on the right side of the issue. But if you ever get down to the point where it's the other way around, the program, you're going to lose. And so I would hope that all of you would see it that way, because that's the decision I have made. Well, the battle of the budget will be a tough one. You'll have some tough votes. Let me say, vote your consciences, whatever they are, secure. I respect it. You are with us, of course, you can't just vote with this. I, of course, will understand it. I can only say this, that the British parliamentary system, all of you, of course, everybody who's in conference has studied a lot of political parliamentary history. There's only one vote that is one that requires total party loyalty. That's the budget. A budget can bring down a government. And it does. There are many others in a vote of confidence. You can even have a prime minister can lose. But on the budget, that is the one that, of course, is the most important. We don't have that kind of discipline in our parties and in our country. I'm not suggesting that we should have. But I am saying that as far as the budget is concerned, it is, in terms of presidential and party leadership, the most important thing. And on this floor, we would hope that when Jerry Ford, the leaders, when you sit down and caucus your own people, that you can realize on the budget items, it comes down time and time and again, not to a matter of principle, but a matter of partisanship. I would suggest that all of our friends on the other side are partisan. A lot of them are. And they get a little more partisan on the vote of this stuff. So we will appreciate, let us put it that way. If they're partisan, you ought to be partisan for us. In other words, the golden rule of politics is do unto others as they do unto you. Unfortunately, I had an interesting conversation with this in my area the other day. And for those of you who know me, have these sits in the middle, right, and I sit in the one on the left. Usually, Mr. sits over here, and Ambassador sits over here, it's all this private conversation. And I was explaining to her, our economic policies, our trade policy, which I want to spend this moment with you too. And I would say, you see, Ms. Meyer, what we're doing here in this field is we're asking the price to go up as well as down, because we're willing to let other people come into our markets and let us do theirs. It's going to be reciprocal, one day street is gone. And I said, as you know, it's a global international policy, and what do others as they do with you. Henry Kissinger said, plus 10%.
Looking, for example, at the Russian summit and how we got the arms control agreement. Let me point out
two things. There was a very critical vote in the United States Senate before you got here. Several, but it was on the ABM you all heard about. Before the ABM, were you against it? Those that were for the ABM were considered to be the militarists, people that wanted more armaments. And those that were against the ABM were considered to be the disarmaments, the pacifists, those that were for peace. And that's the way the votes went. We won it by one vote, by the presidents. It was just exactly the other way around. If we did not have, and had not have indeed, the time we went to Moscow, the ABM, we wouldn't have gotten agreement. Because our interest was in getting the Russians to limit their big offensive weapons, CSS-9. And unless we had something we were doing that they wanted to stop, they wouldn't think of stopping what they were doing. So international policy is like every other phase of life. You can only get it when you have something to give. In other words, we got something from the Russians in this whole area because the United States was strong. And then we were able to negotiate an agreement. If we had not been strong, if we had been weaker than they when we got there, they would have had no incentive whatever, for example, to make a deal. For example, this year, we're going to negotiate, you know, what is called MBMR, Mutual Balanced Force Reduction. And many already anticipating or suggesting, well, let's cut NATO, cut our NATO forces by 30,000, 50,000, 100,000, 150,000. Let's demonstrate our good faith in advance. You demonstrate your good faith in advance, and there will be no mutual reduction. It will only mean we'll go down, and they will stay up, and Europe and America will be in a very dangerous position. We're ready to go down, but only if they do. So what you have to do is to realize that, based on our experience, we're going to negotiate, but we have to negotiate not from a position of weakness, but from a position of strength. That's why we're going to have to ask you to stick with us on a defense budget, which incidentally in terms of level is not one that compared to what it was 4 years ago is any higher than it was then. Despite the fact that spending for domestic purposes has gone up double. The other thing that's required in addition to a strong national defense is respect. You may remember the tough decision which was made in your primary campaign. Or if you didn't have primaries, this one was making into your campaign in May of last year. I remember some candidates, I don't think any of you that I recall, some senatorial candidates, said, well, that blows the election. Because on May 8th of 1972, if you recall, there was a huge communist offensive in Vietnam. And the various news magazines and the rest were talking about the specter of defeat and all that. And so we had to do something. But we were confronted with a terrible dilemma. 3 weeks from that, we were going to Moscow. We had all laid out what we were going to agree. It was going to be a very successful summit. So here, we had to make a decision. Do we go to Moscow and allow the communist offensive to sweep over Vietnam, South Vietnam, or do we do something? So I made the decision to do it. I made the decision for a fundamental reason, as you will understand. I made the decision to mine and blockade and announce it on television on May 8th. And that boy did it at the time. We came all over the country. The editorial writers said, Nixon has blown his job or his back or this, that, or the other thing. This is going to destroy the sun. There isn't any possible way for Russia to come to the sun. They did. And we went. And negotiating that, not only because we were strong, but because they knew we would use our strength, we were respected. Put yourself in a different position. There were those who said, do nothing. Let it go. Don't take the risk of mining and blockading in order to stop the offensive. I can tell you, knowing the communists, I've known them perhaps longer than anybody to talk about today, at close hand, because I was to know them when I was fresh in Congress. But knowing them, if we had gone, I had been in the Kremlin, at a time of Soviet tanks, we're rumbling through the streets of Hue, or even on the outskirts of Saigon. Brezhnev would have just rolled over me, and that means the United States, like a truck, because he would have had no respect. What I'm simply suggesting here is that our policy requires strength, it requires respect, lonely in our positions. I don't think we're going to be anything like that in their future. You won't have to be put to that. But I do want you to know that the reasons for these are not simply rations, but it's based on a calculated proposition that this country at this time, in its dealings at this critical period with both the Soviet Union and with China, communist China, has to have a policy of strength and but also respect. Let me just say one other thing, which on a very controversial subject, which I know many of you may feel differently from now, and which I would ask you respectfully to withhold your judgment. I think perhaps the toughest vote I had as a freshman congressman was on aid to Japan and aid to China. Because believe me, after World War II, I hated the Japanese, particularly I was in the Pacific. And a lot of people have good reason to hate the Germans. Not as a race and so forth, but because of what their division has done, but what they have visited upon the earth. And also, Truman was president. I didn't take my chance then. From that time, I learned to respect him far more later. My point is, when he presented those programs of mass invade to Germany, Japan, I hold my district. It was 70% against me. This is out in the old 12 district, Whittier, Alhambra, Monroe, and so forth, small towns. Basically, isolationists. If that period has changed somehow, but it's still pretty conservative. And yet, I voted for it, as did a great number of us who were Republicans, for a reason that seemed to me quite important. The Japanese had been a very warlike people. This war, the Germans, had a record of being somewhat warlike. It seemed to me that what we needed was to make some investment, if we possibly could, in turning them from the pursuits of war into the avenues of peace. And it worked. It was one of the best investments the United States ever made. Oh, we're paying some price for it now because, ironically, our major competitors in the free world are the Japanese first and the Germans second. But it's much better to have them competing with us economically than competing with us militarily. And that's what the name of the game was. When you hear about aid to North Vietnam, let us understand first, there's nothing before you now. There will be nothing before you unless and until the agreements are complied with. Of course, other nations will be participating in it. As I said in the news conference the other day, any request that comes will come out of the current budget request for military and military assistance, military and foreign assistance. But let me suggest this. And weigh it not with the parochial view. It's so easy to be parochial to say, why do I hate them when I need more for my school or for my exam or this or that or the other thing? Point is, not because we are thinking simply in those parochial terms, but because we are trying to look at it in terms of an investment in peace. Now that's not the cliche and all the rest. But let me tell you, there have been certainly men who have different attitudes in this office, and certainly others, people who have great advantages over me. But in terms of a hard-headed approach to foreign policy, I think even my critics would say, I perhaps am as hard as anybody's ever been here. I would only say that I will recommend this to the Congress only under circumstances in which other nations are participating in doing their share, under circumstances that will come out of the existing military and foreign assistance budget, and under circumstances where I am convinced that such assistance gives us a better chance to have the North Vietnamese turn their efforts inward to the works of peace rather than outward to the works of aggression, which could, of course, lead to what none of us want, more war in that part of the world, which could splash over into places like Thailand, the Philippines, and so forth, when we have treaties with all the consequences that would be involved. The other point that I would like to make is that on this whole area, trade and rest, when we send our trade bill down, it's going to be quite different from what we face then. When I was a freshman, I recall I voted for reciprocal aid. I didn't think much of it at the time because my constituents were totally against it. But on the other hand, again, it was wrong. At that time, the United States was looking out everybody's throat economically. Europe was on its back. Japan was on its back. We were the only people in the free world, so we had the biggest market. And we needed, of course, to build that up and get some trade going. So we opened up our markets. We lowered our barriers. We did it then, we did it the Kennedy round, and we've been doing that for 25 years. But now, Japan's on its feet, very diverse competitors. The Germans are on their feet. The new Europe is joining together to compete with this. So here's where Big Michael the Rule comes in. Instead of presenting to the Congress as is traditionally been the case, trade legislation, we ask you to give us the right to negotiate reductions of tariffs. We want the right to go up as well as down. Because if we find a country which wants to come into our market, but has non-tariff barriers, or has other barriers which keeps us out of their markets, and it's no dice, the days of the one-way street and economic foreign policy are over. As far as we're concerned, whether the Germans, the Japanese, the British, our friends, or our adversaries, it's pure, shall we say, pragmatism. We're willing to have good relations with them economically, but American goods must have the same right to get into their market that their goods have to get into ours. And that is why, give us, not that the president wants the power, you see the power of that. I talked to Will Hills down here the other day, plus one. I talked about this thing. And I said, now you fellows have all been talking about too much power in the presidency. I said, believe me, there's nothing I would like less than to have this here. Because the moment you have this power, and then every one of your constituents, the piano makers and this thing, the watchmakers over here, I guess we don't make watches anymore. But anyway, whatever the case might be, they'll come in common and they can say, look, they're driving us out of business. You've got to use this power that you've got to raise the tariffs. Nevertheless, I am convinced that unless we do have that authority, the president and his representatives will not be able to negotiate a deal that will save our own jobs. Let me put that whole economic thing in one context for just a moment. When I was out talking with my old adversary and now sometimes friends to me at the end of the day, and he is personally, let me say, and in this last 4 years, case after case, others who served would not stand by, whether it was the May decision to mine and bomb, whether it was the Cambodian decision, or whether it was keeping America's defense strong. Whatever the difference we have with organized labor, the meetings and the Fitzsimmons and the Brennan stood like a rock. Without them, we couldn't have done it. So let's not mock them. Now the point that I say, on this point, however, we had some differences in other people. It was great, I agree with that. The position taken by much of organized labor is support for a country. And the argument they make is, look, we import $50 billion to the United States. Now that's $50 billion worth of jobs that were taken away, in effect, we say. That's the deficit shows one side of the coin. We also export $50 billion abroad. And so, if we decide to put a wall up here that keeps those $50 billion or a substantial part of it out of the United States, it will certainly save the jobs that those imports might take away. But it would cost us the jobs that the exports otherwise would gain us. So, what is in our interest, of course, is to have a balance. We want to continue to export and have a balance between export and import, and that's what's best for the American working man. That's the kind of trade policy we're for. I, for example, was talking to some automobile dealers last night, and had Chrysler's. He made this point about foreign cars and the rest. We have a lot of talk about it. I said, what do you really think about it? Well, he said, we were talking the other day in Detroit, the big tree. I decided we better get the antitrust division out. So we were talking. And what we found is that as far as our jobs are concerned, as far as our cars are concerned, that we did have a problem with foreign imports. And not that they don't want us to work in that problem, that's why we saw it, of course. But, he said, on the other hand, we find we're exporting more than we're somebody was going to cut off our exports just to protect us against the imports. Well, let me say, we understand that. And this is a highly sophisticated, difficult area. But I would urge you, of course, think of your constituents, pound the table, and give us the names of the Commerce Department or the White House, do they necessarily about their needs, and we'll try to respond to them. But remember, this area, if you will, we're looking after. This is an administration that's not going to give away the store. That was done before we ever got here. And that's what we're trying to do, is to restore the balance and to get a fair shake of American products and the American all over the world. I'm going to make one last point that is more than this rather extended thing. Is perhaps that's what needs to be said to this group, because you ran in the year 72, you won. You had to be courageous. You had to stand up against the slings and arrows of those who told you that the only way to for the United States to have peace was to have been dishonored in any way and so forth. Anyone who is in this room, anyone who sits at this desk, has to think about what he would like to leave. I don't have that compulsion that President Johnson may have had. I'm not saying this critically of him, because each man is different. He felt very strongly about his place in history. I'm more a fatalist, as you know. Place in history will be determined not by what the instant historians or the instant commentators say, but what they write 25 years from now. And no one knows what that will be. No one can guess. But I do know what we want. In the next 4 years, and this is a great thing that we're going to work together for, we have made more progress toward a peaceful world, a bigger breakthrough in 1 year, 1972, than has made in all the years since World War II. It's an historic change. The world is different now. The game has been changed. The game's been opened up. And there's a chance to make us gold. But it's not here yet. We've got to continue our strength. We've got to continue our respect. We've got to continue also a strong America, economically free, with the private enterprise system that gives us the major advantage we have over the Soviet and over the United Nations. There's one other factor that we need that I've often addressed myself to. I want to say just one word about that as I conclude. I often read late at night the history of nations. And what always impresses me is that the great civilizations and great nations of the past have been strong and rich and yet have gone down. Because they didn't have here, and they didn't have here. In other words, it was a lack of character rather than a lack of wealth. It was a lack of spirit, a lack of discipline. The more wealthy they became, the softer they became. And we must not let that happen to America. That's what really I want to leave with you more than anything else. I know many of us have had that brought home to us as we've seen these POWs come back. Here they were, away so long, and they come back. Their heads high, saluting and so forth. Let me say one thing. If we had bugged out just to get them back, they would have done it. And if there's one thing that I think we can be proud of, the fact that we ended this war in a way that made their sacrifice and those that died worthwhile, to see them come back saluting, standing straight, saying, God bless America, made it all worthwhile to stand for that period of time. Unmistakably reached a brilliant blossoming stage. Most particularly, Thank you for biting the bullet in the political sense by arriving at the decision to use the B-52s, which not only brought us home, but perhaps put many of our previous half-actions in the Vietnam War in better perspective. Those of us who ran prison camps may have had jobs similar to yours, my cousin. I realize that we had an advantage, because we and the men under us were under constant physical pressure during the early years. As you surely know from personal experience, pressure catalyzes the ennobling process involved in questing for and inevitably finding sufficient divine help to hack it somehow. Though I have pride in America's past, hope for her future, I believe that recently too many of her citizens may have developed through soft environment a blurred awareness of fundamentals, such as a recognition of the rights and needs of authority. Such rights are corollary to the very first of the Ten Commandments. They are the lifeblood of nations. With such weaknesses prominent and prevalent among many of our citizens, including congressmen, added to the bewildering complexity of your problems, I can sense something of the immensities of the pressures acting on you as you pursue your mission. I'm grateful that the nation has you in office, and is perhaps the most common time in our history. So many Americans have expressed to me the hope that God will use us returning POWs to arouse our citizens to some new awareness. I intend to tackle this task as opportunity permits, not by providing physical pressure, but by motivating people to self-imposition of their own intellectual pressure. I have been more than compensated for my ordeal, my own simple satisfaction with having done my duty. My families, my countrymen, has expressed an appreciation therefore. The glorious worthiness of our national spirit, which deserves any sacrifice expressly appreciated or not. Any one of these three factors would have been more than compensation. But thank you again. The creative expression of your own personal gratitude. And it's signed by Captain Jeremiah. And I simply want to say to you, sometimes we get so obsessed with the details, this veto, this vote, this appropriation, but this speech, that we lose sight of the big picture, we lose sight of the vision of a man who for 7 years much of the solitary confinement of prison camp in Vietnam. And so the great goals as I see them, I want to work with you in these next 4 years, first to keep this country strong, to build a world of peace, to keep our economy strong, so that people can have the progress that we're entitled to. But above everything else, I want to work with you to restore the spirit and the faith of America, faith in God, faith in our country and faith in ourselves that Dad talks about. That's what I would like for you to do. Thank you.
Try to do on our part to create an initiative along this line for cohesiveness of the freshman class and some of the senior members of the party. I think you put these things in very good perspective for us. We appreciate it, and we're behind you, and we particularly appreciate your sensitivity to our needs in being reelected 2 years from now. And your comments along the line that if we had some problems, you didn't tell us who to call, that you've got some good men back here. And if we can know that you told them to look out for us from the agency.
I want you to know this, that I understand. You come from different districts. Some people can vote against anything until they want to. Others, I'm not speaking of others, but many people differ in their views, whether or not they're from the Republican Party. We have a little few people different views, I understand. It is often that Jerry Forrest or people will say this is party loyal. And often they'll say, look, here's what we don't need here. And that's what you go out. We understand. But when you do see something where it does involve basically a vote of confidence and the whole big strategy, then you've got to know, and then you've got to be in on the game. I used to appreciate when the leaders in those days were Joe Martin and Charlie Howell. And Joe was a speaker, and Charlie was still a judge. I believe he was a speaker somehow over here. But anyway, we wanted to know that, and that makes it easier to go with. But my voting record was pretty high for about the percentage, not total 100%. I would expect all yours to be. I simply want you to know that however you are, we just want you back. And we'll understand if you don't we'll appreciate it, but it'll help me, however, it'll help me help get you back if we didn't have as much support as you in good conscience can give us. That's all I have. Okay. Now I want to show you something to take. But you realize I had a birthday the other day. I have a very good friend from New York. He didn't know what to get me. And so he made this plaque. What it says, for the man who has almost everything. As a matter of fact, by the way, Kissinger here today, that he's on a secret mission. Mr. Boston trying to normalize relations. Thank you, Mr. President. Hope you are late to dinner.
Thank you, President. If
you're late to dinner, make the other guy pick up the chance. Oh, okay, yeah, come on over. Lead these guys, lead them. I have never known